G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, episode 258. Charles is sad and Cromwell is dead. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. Dear listener, if you ever feel like you need a good boo-hoo-hoo but just can't get there, can't get those tears coming out, whack on a bit of Schubert. That'll get you crying. Last week saw Charles make a daring escape all the way out of England after the failure of his Scottish army to get him in the big chair. He got booted out of France and the duchies didn't really want him, so we've got him in Germany. Royalists in England had a bit of a go at rebellion, but Cromwell has everything under control. The English were waiting to see the huge benefits we'll be getting from our going to a civil war, booting out the king and installing a republic. The result was pretty much more of the same, except Christmas has been cancelled. Future Charles II, still in Cologne, will want to get a treaty going with the Spanish. That's a nice job to make you feel important. Hyde is out of favour because he'd organised an uprising in England that, oddly enough, was a total dud. 200 royalists neatly bowled over by 60 soldiers with a few executions, a couple of leaders doing a runner, then indentured servitude for the rest. If you're wondering whether Parliament was harsh, then wonder no more. One poor old bugger was arrested for saying he wished he'd joined the royalists. The reason he didn't join the royalists was because he was 78. 78! And he got transported to Barbados. Very harsh. Back to Spain, who Charles wants to make his friends. That's because Parliament has upped the aggression in the West Indies and had taken Jamaica. War will be declared, but there'll be just warring in the West Indies, really. And I think Henry Morgan's about to sail in, the famous pirate. Anyway, everybody wants the West Indies right now. So it's a good time for Charles to be friendly with the Spanish. On the unhappy side, Mazarin and Cromwell were getting to be good buddies. And the news is in that the Poms are talking up King Oliver the First. That will lead to a reduction of circumstances for our royal exiles. Like a food, we'll see supporters slipping back to England to make their peace with the government. There's no money even to pay for laundry. Some dickhead will send Charles a present of 100 doggies. How the fuck's he going to feed 100 doggies? He won't be able to do it. Charles is living on credit, and oh horror. He's down to just one dish for dinner. He'll have to eat just what he's been given. And there's no leftovers for the beggars at the gate. Charles is running up substantial debts for his court's necessities with no money for anything else. One guy writes that he can't accept invitations. He's too shabby. Another guy is desperate. His missus and kitty are sick and there's no money for a doctor. A Scotty knight will complain that his landlord is unhappy with unpaid rent. Lord Norwich will have to cut out a singed bit of his coat. English spies are writing with pity in their hearts. How will they all live? God knows. I'm sure I do not. Oh, the misery, my dear listener. Rich people problems are very real, I assure you. At least I've got plenty of time to write poetry. For him I threw lands, honour, wealth away, and one dear hope that was prized more than they. For him I languished in a foreign clime, grey-haired with sorrow in my manhood's prime. Yeah, we're watching Bridget in season 2, still on about the troubles that beset the super-wealthy. No common filthy smellies on Struggle Street in sight in that TV show. At least more courtiers are sneaking off to England, causing more worry. If we get a King Oliver I, then these royalists will be forced to take an oath to the new king. And we know from the past, do we not know, my dear listener, that oaths are binding for life, or until next week. We still like to believe they're for life against all the evidence. Worse, of course, for Charles, who is writing to English royalists along the lines that England cannot know peace until glorious me is restored to my possession. For the guys in England, peace looks more likely under Cromwell than Charles. Fair call. Charles is looking to get Spain to declare war on England over Jamaica. The idea is that Spain would then go on to get Charles restored. His advisers are saying, yeah, look, we're a bit doubtful on that second bit, mate. I'd be saying, listen, dickhead, that's the sort of stuff that got your dad's head off. Wanting Spain to invade England is about as stupid as you can get. Charles's best bet was to look to act as a peacemaker. Charles will decide that Cologne is too far away from the action. He wants to move. One thing that had interested Charles was seeing an English guy, George Jolly, provider of entertainments like plays. He was allowed in Germany. Remember, we're not letting these guys do plays in England. But he was allowed in Germany and allowed to employ girlies to play the girly parts. Charles thought that was pretty good, and so do we, do we not? Charles wants to get to Spanish territory in the lowlands to see Don Juan, illegitimate son of the latest Spanish Phil IV. Don Juan is the governor in the lowlands, and his pay grade would involve treaty making. March 1656, and Charles is in Brussels for tea and a chat. Charles, though, is bothered that he doesn't know Spanish protocol. How does one address a kingly bastard? And, of course, he can't speak Spanish. There's no such thing as a Spanish-English dictionary, so what you do is get yourself a copy of the magic book in Spanish and try to learn the language from that. Charles wants proper communication. He'll get off to a good start with an amount of pocket money agreed for both himself and brother Jim. Spanish ports open to English royalist privateers and a promise of Spanish hardmen to get Charles onto the English big chair. Charles will agree to remove all fines and penalties against English Catholics. He'll make an alliance with Irish Catholics, and royalist soldiers working for France will go to assist the Spaniards. You're not sure the English will like these ideas, and in fact they won't. Jim by now was doing the military stuff for France, and Mazarin was talking up giving him his own command in Italy. Now he's expected to fight for Spain, and he's not having it. James is off to the duchies to sulk, but the Duke of Gloucester, youngest brother Henry, will fight for the Spanish. Jim went off to Sister Mary, Princess of Orange, who also does not like the Spanish deal. She's looking to protect the interests of baby William, who the duchies want to reduce by removing the prince title, and this deal isn't helping. Mother Queen Mary in France is also in an awkward position with the Spanish deal. Sister Mary is off to Mother Mary so they can have a good old girl's gossip about this stick of an idea and hopefully be overheard so everyone knows they don't like it. Gossip magazines also had it that young Mary was eyeing off Louis XIV as marriage material. Whether that was real or not, Mary was flirting with Henry German's nephew, Harry German. Henry's the uncle, Harry's the... Future King Charles then has squabbling advisers and now family disharmony. Queen Mary isn't helping at all, having gone all missionary with the Catholic thingy. Charles isn't looking to convert. He knows that would kill his chances of getting his bum on the big chair. That won't stop Charles from being attacked by parliamentary spies on the charge that he looks a bit Catholic. I can reveal to you, my dear listener, that Charles will convert sometime in his life, but we'll never know when that happened. The only thing we know for sure is that he died a Catholic. For the meantime, it'll be deny, deny, deny for Charles. We should also remember his granddad, Henri IV, swapped religions every time it suited him politically. At this stage, the Spanish aren't telling Charles to convert, but he will visit Catholic churches, and reports are out saying that he actually did a Catholic magic show. That shouldn't be a big deal. I myself have attended a couple of Catholic magic shows. Doesn't make me a Catholic. Jim, though, is attending more than the odd magic show, and he will convert sometime soon. That is, Charles's brother, James. Queen Mary, though, will make a solid attempt at converting Prince Henry, the Duke of Gloucester, and Charles will rip it up both him and his mum. Look, Mum, are you trying to stop me getting the English silly hat or what? If you start converting a prince, then I'll be forced to denounce him, which will piss off the English Catholics while making the English Protestants very suspicious about us. So lay off. Oh, he got one in there. And Mum, just remember what my dear old dad said to Henry. Never ever convert, kiddo, that's what he said. No matter what, Henry, he said, so lay off. Henry will stay Protestant and be off to Sister Mary in Protestant Holland. Well, he'll stay Protestant for a while. This news gets out to England, and the way Charles dealt with it will score him points. English Catholics get it and are okay, and Protestants say, hey, look, he's firmly on our team. He may be totally reliant on the Frenchies and Spanish for pocket money, but he's sticking with the true Protestant religion. Charles will also write a nice bit of propaganda about parliamentary attacks that he attended the Catholic magic show. Good news for me, he wrote. If it's just this sort of bullshit they use to attack me, well, what do they think? Do they think I enjoy being banished to a Catholic country? Grow a brain, dickheads. Yeah, nice work there, Charles. Still, the Catholic gossip will grow. Charles met with a cardinal and so on. The only evidence of anything Catholic goes to the Pope, where Charles wrote to one of his guys, hey, if the fat rich guy in Rome were to give me a nice gift, I would not be in a position to refuse. But there's no nice big fat gift coming from the Pope. Charles is looking to be the only hope for English Catholics to get the penal laws repealed, but Cromwell as Lord Protector was laying off them while not actually repealing the laws. Cromwell's looking to be on the good side of the Pope and the Frenchies. As a result, conversions to Catholic are growing in England, and Catholics attending magic shows at foreign embassies are likewise growing. So Charles's position is weakened on this matter. Meanwhile, negotiations with Don Juan are very slow. It's known as the Spanish method, where the Spanish deliberately take their time. At the same time, the Spanish think that it's a bad look to host Charles in Brussels. Charles then is off to Bruges, still in Belgium, a lovely town and much closer to England. If you get a chance, visit for some of the lovely streets and buildings. At this time, its looks are about it. That's all they've got. It's a backwater with trade in decline and generally considered to be a dead end of a town. Marvellous place for me to be in exile, but not the action centre that Charles would like. Still, he can move in with an Irish royalist who will be rewarded in future, and the town notables will be very pleasant to a visiting king. He is king of the Scots, after all. He'll be patron of a guild or two, and they will also be rewarded in the future, indicating he must have at least found the place pleasant. The parliamentary propagandists can now have a go at Charles for extravagance, fornication, drunkenness and adultery, and all good fun, I reckon. But the propagandists point out that God will be very cross, so Charles will never, ever, ever get to be King of England. And the propaganda does have foundation. Elizabeth Killigrew, 8 years older than Charles and pretty tasty, will knock out a daughter. She was married already, so that's a tick for adultery and fornication. Catherine Pegg, hot chick, will knock out a son, who will be known as Don Carlo. And then a nice cougar, Lady Byron, who won't knock out any kiddies but score a nice royal pension in thanks for her services in draining the kingly balls. There are more unnamed maidens, my dear listener. Charles is certainly into the whole consenting adults thing. The reality of the banging around is that for most people, it's standard royal behaviour for a prince, and besides, the useless propagandists aren't getting their stories quite right, so it's not sticking that well. Charles is also writing about it as nonsense, pulling a Mick Jagger on Parliament, saying, I wouldn't have the time to bang half the chicks they say I'm banging. Well played again. You don't admit anything, you don't deny, you're just saying, look, they're just exaggerating. About the most outrage Parliament can muster was that Charles had Frenchy players in for entertainment on the Holy Sabbath. The truth of the matter seems that Charles was on a bit of a down about his future. He's also at risk from assassination, has to work with his spies on intelligence and counterintelligence, and he's continually looking for cash. Not a lot of fun in that lot. Now, speaking of hot chicks that Charles has banged, Welsh hottie Lucy Water, with Charles' son James Scott, is wanting to go to The Hague. Well, she's trying to go there, but Charles wants her out of the way because she'd stir up more propaganda. Lucy has just been involved in scandal after scandal. Charles had persuaded her to go back to England, where Cromwell promptly tossed her in the tower under suspicion of being a spy. Now she's been deported and told to go back to the Lowlands, but Charles doesn't want her anywhere, really. She's been in trouble for procuring abortions, accused of murdering a maid, had a couple of more illegitimate kiddies, and is now back looking for money. Being a king's floozy is very profitable, so long as your king isn't flat broke. Don't worry, Charles. That syphilis will see her off to heaven pretty darn soon. But there is a problem that she's got Charles' son with her, and we want him. Kidnapping will be the go, and he will soon be with Granny Queen Mary. Probably not a bad thing, really, getting him away from Lucy. Charles also had his eye on a more serious relationship. Henrietta Catherine of Orange, sister of the recently dead William Prince of Orange. A union between the two big Protestant houses might not be a bad idea. He had already been looked at for Henrietta's sister Louise, but that was when the Orange mob thought that the Stuarts might be done for. Apart from politics, Henrietta Catherine was what they called in the olden days high-spirited. She's already stood up for herself and knocked back an arranged marriage, and well done, Henrietta. Standing up to her mum Amelia would have been a pretty tough call, I think. Charles is falling in love with her by correspondence. He'll start the courting thing. Apart from love and fucking like a bunny, there is also that slow treaty with the Spanish going on. They had talked up the military stuff, so Charles will form a regiment. 1656, meet the King's Guards. They say a name in 1656, but they will become known as the Grenadiers. Yes, it's those lads with the big, furry, funny hats who hang out at Buckingham Palace. They were formed by Charles in Bruges. Grenadiers, because they just love chucking hand grenades. Top fun. It's not just the Grenadiers. Charles is looking to raise an international brigade to fight for Spain. Usual leaders, Duke Jim, Earl of Bristol Dickhead Digby, and the Earl of Newburgh. Who cares about him? Not us.
Happening! Forward! Right!
Yeah, there go the Grenadiers marching into a glorious war. Somewhere. There's always a war. Parliamentary spies observing these troops and their magnificent leaders will report, yeah, nothing much to be worried about here. They're pretty useless, a lot of them. Typically under-resourced, underpaid, underfed, and just making trouble wherever they are. Discipline is just crap. Where's the Spanish gold, you ask? Yeah, so does Charles. Don Juan has been renamed Don Devil by our English royalists. But off go our brave boys to war, with Charles told to stay home. Brothers Jim and Harry will be the ones looking for glory. Charles is about as miserable as he thinks he can get. Then, George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, his BFF, will be off back to England. Now, the colony of Massachusetts had gone through English law and simplified it. We'd like to have a good look at doing that in England too. Some shocking reforms will be put in. No longer will you be executed for a first offence of pickpocketing or stealing a horsey. We'll no longer burn women alive for anything. Yeah, isn't that great, lady listeners? We're not going to set you on fire anymore. Nobody will cop that being pressed to death with the big weights loaded on. Despite all this, plenty of people are wondering when the real reform will be coming. It still looks very much like the government under Charles. Conservatives are all yelling out the slippery slope argument, with the bottom of that slope being an attack on property rights. Churchy types are yelling out about their ties. Don't take our ties away. Cromwell can see it's all another dud, this current parliament. Whether you arrange it or not, Conservatives will walk out saying, all you guys are doing is looking to take away our property. We're out. They'll go to Cromwell saying, you take all our authority. 16th of December 1653, and Cromwell is declared Lord Protector. Yeah, we had those before, haven't we? They didn't work out that well. You know what we haven't had for a while? War, huh? What is it good for? So let's have one. We passed legislation about training ships coming in must be English owned. That's because the duchies are doing so well, our balance of trade is out of whack. Even our colonies prefer trading with the duchies because they're so good at it. The duchies have by now booted the Portuguese out of the East Indies and Brazil and have the spice trade nicely tied up. English ships are rotting in their harbours. The English Navy and privateers will swing into action. 1651 and 140 duchy ships are seized. 1652, 30, but still, there's 30 ships. Duchies will complain to Parliament. A delegation will go to The Hague to try a deal, but it's difficult, and the English decide the duchies are hostile. What it looks like is a repeat of the old Spanish days where guys like Francis Drake looked to get rich just by knocking off Spanish treasure ships. Duchies will increase their firepower by fitting 150 merchant ships as warships. Their instructions are defence only, lads, no offensive action. English, though, will, of course, say it's duchy aggression. Yeah, that's what we always do. Neither side wants an all-out war, but there will be an unfortunate incident. Duchy Top Admiral Martin Tromp will be escorting 40 duchy ships when he bumps into Top English General at sea, Robert Blake, with 25 ships. Two big swinging hard men dicks bumping into each other has got to see battle. 29th of May 1652, Battle of Dover. We need a reason to engage, so let's make one up. Blake will dip his flag in salute. It's the polite thing to do. Tromp will not dip his flag in reply. What a fucking prick. Blake will fire three warning shots, and so he should. Fucking Martin Tromp not dipping his flag. Third one, they will actually hit Tromp's ship, and it's on. 5-hour battle, lots of damage, with two duchy merchantmen taken. Duchies will send their highest official to England for talk, saying, hey guys, we really don't want war. The English will make outrageous demands that the duchies simply couldn't accept. Yeah, we do that a lot too, don't we? 10th of July, 1652, England declares war, heart, what is it good for? Fixing up our balance of trade, that's what it's good for. Ambassador returning to The Hague will sum it up nicely. The English are about to attack a mountain of gold. We are about to attack a mountain of iron. Yeah. Cromwell will make a speech to confirm the social order will not be changed. The class system will stay because equality is a bad, bad thing, against the natural order of a society. The speech will go down well. The audience is rich people, so of course it'll go down well. What's he got for poor people? Taxes on popular goods that had not previously been taxed. Yes, it definitely is same shit, different flies. In London, we get the rise of the oligarchy, which is generally taken to be a bad, bad thing for a very, very good reason. We've got guys getting super rich and overly powerful. Bishops are back, nobles are restored to their titles. It's almost like the revolution never happened. Now, here's a statement that's been true for about 950 years. Ireland remains a problem. 34,000 English soldiers are there who hadn't been purged of radicals. It's a huge cost to England, so the numbers will be reduced to 20,000. A new plan is proposed, which thankfully won't happen. Australians will know about the stolen generation where Indigenous kiddies were taken from their parents to grow up in a white society. That was the plan for the Irish Catholic kiddies. Take them from their mums and bring them up Protestant. Cromwell is encouraging English to migrate to Ireland as colonialists, but Why go there for a shit life when you can have a shit life right here in England? In fact, Ireland is demonstrably worse for common smelly English. Irish and Papists are excluded from any areas where there are opportunities to make a decent living. They are to remain as the peasants working menial jobs. Plots are happening against the government. We got royalist plots along with leftover leveller plots, and neither of those really matter. Cromwell has a firm grip and a professional army. Even so, it's a bother. There are pamphlets coming out saying we should kill Cromwell. Cromwell will hit the propaganda warning against the dangers of his opponents getting to be in charge. Yeah, you think I'm bad, you should see the other bloke. If a commonwealth must perish, that is perished by men, and not by the hands of persons differing little from beasts. That if it needs must suffer, it should suffer from rich men, rather than from poor men. Overall, England is still a military state. Politicians have got nothing, while Cromwell has an army, and the council is stacked with military types, their friends and relatives. One guy will suggest to Cromwell that 90% of the population is against him. Sure, says Cromwell, but it's my 10% who have the weapons. Who knows if it was 90%, but there is certainly a very large group of English who want Cromwell gone. On the other side, more fanatical Republicans are pushing for international war. Go to France and Spain and turn them into republics. Let's bowl over Rome type of erratic thinking. But we do need a foreign policy. Step one is pretty easy to get agreement on. We need to smash Dutch e-commerce to bits so we can be fabulously wealthy. This, though, is further confirmation that religious wars are out. We want a war against the duchies, and at least we are being totally upfront that this war is about money. We can't bullshit our way through it, calling it to defend the true religion, and of course it'll be ages before marketing come up with this stupid we're fighting for freedom and democracy bullshit. Really, it's we're fighting for limited freedoms and representative democracy. Yeah, nobody's going to go and fight for that shit if we were honest with them. While that's going on, we want to go belting up the Spanish, particularly around the West Indies. The West Indies are becoming very hot property, and lots of humans will be able to die fighting for one side or the other. This one, of course, will be a nice anti-Catholic crusade. We need to bring the West Indies to the true faith. Yeah, we haven't totally given away the idea of religious wars. In fact, the action will be in North America. 1654, and Cromwell will send ships to capture duchy colonies there. Annoyingly, at the last minute, we'll sign a treaty with the duchy, so hitting their colonies is a bad look. Our guys will still head off, but they're going to go to Frenchy Nova Scotia, and it's ours now. Nice bit of coal and copper there. Back to that treaty with the duchies, and one clause England wanted in was the exclusion of the House of Orange from big jobs in the Netherlands. Yes, yes, we want the oranges out. See, we've stopped wanting to tell other countries what religion we want them to have, and now immediately we're telling the duchies to become a full-blown republic, like us. Cromwell saw it as damaging to Prince Charles and royals generally. Other foreign policy will be pro-France, anti-Spain. We go anti-Spanish because our mob still hate the Spanish the most, plus it allows us to go hunting Spanish treasure ships. But don't think of this like the good old days of Drake and Company, because it's also about taking over the West Indies. Cromwell will be trying to get colonialists from Ireland or North America to transfer to Jamaica. That's the main goal, with side orders of breaking the Spanish monopoly of South American trade and overtaking the duchies as the most powerful navy in the world. Picking up the contents of handy treasure ships will help to fund all this. Our settlement at Providence Island, founded by the Pilgrim Fathers, hasn't been supported by the government. It's now a holy pirate station. That lets us know that we need to make a major effort to establish and maintain a base in the West Indies. There certainly will be competition from the Spanish, Frenchies and Dutch. The West Indies is going to be highly significant for about 150 years. And Jamaica will end up becoming the major centre for the slave trade. Initially, it slaves to fill the West Indies, then to meet the demand in America. English towns like Bristol and Liverpool will end up making a squillion dollars out of all that, but that's in the future. England hasn't forgotten the East. The East India Company is getting government support for trade bases in India. Quid pro quo deal where the company lent the government £50,000 and the government issued a new charter that killed off any ideas of free trade with India. The company has it exclusively, and it's another bad thing. Cromwell's usual efficiency will go missing with this West Indies stuff. A lot of our naval leaders have been sidelined as suspected royalists. Those guys are needed, but they won't get a gig. As for army types to go and do any fighting, the army will use this as an excuse to get rid of soldiers they don't really like. It's the undesirables going. Even so, the duchies will be contained and the problem of French privateers will be addressed. Trade deals will be done with the Portuguese, so on the whole, peaceful trade will improve. English merchants are happy. While we may know the wars of religion are now over, our guys don't know it yet. Foreign policy then was still banging on about religion. Cromwell wanted to be the world's number one defender of the Protestant faith, the true one, and was making overtures to the now mostly fucked Huguenots in France to get that deal with Mazarin, which included booting Charles out of France. It's also propaganda about the Spaniards being anti-Christian. Anti-Christian? How do you work that out? Oh, well. So we have to attack them in South America because of their appalling treatment of indigenous people. A book will be published, The Tears of the Indians, being a historical and true account of the cruel massacres and slaughters of above 20 million innocent people. This was dedicated to Cromwell and called on him to avenge these poor innocent people using the good old eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth policy. And the Spanish are anti-Christian papists, but please don't say that about France because we want to be their friend right now. Tricky. Shall we have a massacre, my dear listener? Why not? We haven't had one for a couple of weeks. This isn't about Spanish indigenous people. It's about Christians, of course. Just as the Grenadier music wants me to whip off to France and kill Frenchies, Hillsong music makes me want to stand in an auditorium with my arms raised, staring at the ceiling and feeling all holy, just right to go and kill Christians. Trouble is, the Hillsong stuff's a bit formulaic. It kind of always follows a pattern. But I still feel a bit holy, so yeah, let's kill some Christians. I'll set the scene and introduce you to the Waldensians, and now I'm doing that, I feel remiss that they haven't been introduced before. These guys go way back to the 12th century. Frenchy outfit founded by one of those many, many humans who thought that the church was excessive in their money-making and failing on the baby Jesus doing stuff. Their leader sold his property to support the poor, and he, with his mates, preached the baby Jesus message. Like the Franciscans, the church did not like these guys preaching the baby Jesus message with all that bloody poverty stuff. That still doesn't get you killed, though. Unlike the Franciscans, the Waldensians did not want to recognise the power players, the bishops. Oh, dear. Now, that will get you into trouble, and some of your members will get killed. On the other hand, it's not like the full-blown heresy of people like the Cathars with their rejection of the three is one and one is three stuff. So it was just the odd killing here and there, but no full destruction of your filthy views. But, and here's the reason they should have been mentioned earlier, when the Reformation comes along, their poverty preaching looks a bit like Protestantism, and now we've got a real problem. So with all the very many heresies or whatever that cropped up right from the start of our Latin church, three stand out as the precursors to the Martin Luther thing. The Hussites, which was covered, John Wycliffe's Lollards, which was covered, and this is the third, the Waldensians. They're nice and neat and tidy, let's get people dead. So it was the Reformation that made us have a closer look at this mob. Here's the Reformation, and our old mate Frankie Big Nose will send in troops for a decent massacre in 1545. Now, 110 years later, the Duke of Savoy has ordered them to either attend Mass or sell up and piss off. It's the middle of winter, so selling up and pissing off isn't really much of an option. Like war, real estate sales are a summer hobby. Savoy, incidentally, is a rather cold place in winter. The Duke of Savoy, I can reveal to you, was oddly enough full of the bullshit. He thought the threat of booting them out would be sufficient to get them to convert, which is what he wanted. A lot of them then will just abandon their homes. They can't sell them, so they'll just wander off to a nearby community. People there will say, great, come on in. Everyone likes a genuine follower of the baby Jesus. They're sweet, nice people. But the Duke is, of course, rather annoyed. He will get his riding types to dodgy up some false reports that the Waldensians are plotting an uprising. They aren't. One thing these people are known for over their 400-whatever-year existence is non-violence and conformity with the government. That's why they just left their homes. The Duke told them to. Oh no, says the Duke, there may be a disturbance about to happen. Hey, you mob up there with the Waldensians, I need to send a peacekeeping force to you to keep the peace. Yes, beware of peacekeeping forces, my dear listener, beware of them. He'll say, sorry about this, but you're going to have to take my hard men into your houses and look after them while they're keeping the peace. I have just mentioned that our Waldensians comply with the government, so, yeah, they'll now accept hard men into their homes. 24th of April 1655 at 4 a.m. sound the trumpets to signal a general massacre. Yes, it may commence with the order being massacre with severe nastiness. My dear gentle listener, I shall repeat that this next passage contains severe nastiness. Little children were torn from the arms of their mothers, clasped by their tiny feet, and their heads dashed against the rocks, or were held between two soldiers and their quivering limbs torn up by main force. Their mangled bodies were then thrown on the highways or fields to be devoured by beasts. The sick and the aged were burned alive in their dwellings. Some had their hands and arms lopped off, and fire applied to the severed parts to staunch the bleeding and prolong their suffering. Some were flayed alive, some were roasted alive, some disemboweled or tied to trees in their own orchards, and their hearts cut out. Some were horribly mutilated, and of others the brains were boiled and eaten by these cannibals. Some were fastened down into the furrows of their own fields and ploughed into the soil, as men plough manure into it. Others were buried alive. Fathers were marched to death with the heads of their sons suspended around their necks. Parents were compelled to look on, while their children were first outraged, that's raped, then massacred, before themselves permitted to die. Yeah, just doing the work of the baby Jesus there. And that report is the one that went out to newspapers around Europe, and Europe was rightly outraged, even though they'd done this type of stuff themselves. There were surviving Waldensians. Yeah, some got out alive. Underground railways were set up to get them out of France. Other countries were very willing to welcome them in. Lots settled in Calvinist Switzerland and the Lowlands. 167 will be sent by the Dutchies to Delaware in the Americas. There is today a Waldensian Presbyterian church. Whether these modern guys are like their founders, I can't tell you. A large number of Waldensians had also gone along with the Mormons to Salt Lake City to be part of that rather odd mob. The modern Waldensian Presbyterians have also established worldwide. Not all of them left the area, though. Those that had left broke with their non-violent tradition formed a guerrilla band to fight back. That will continue even after international pressure was applied to the Duke, who said, OK, if they want to be Waldensians, they can be fucking Waldensians. Violence begets violence, my dear listener. Matthew verse 26:52. Well, it comes from that. The actual Jesus quote was, put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Or perhaps you like a bit of Martin Luther King. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. Fantastic quote, which sadly seems to fail when applied to our mighty and glorious leaders. Let's get back to Cromwell's foreign policy, where he wants to be friends with France, and then in comes the morning paper with that massacre description. Great news, my dear listener. That gives Cromwell leverage to get a great deal and announce it as payback for the massacre. Here's how the world works. Venice will look for a deal that will help them against the infidel Turks. That'll be a no. England has too much capital in the Mediterranean to risk upsetting the Muslims. And Venetians aren't interested in us anyway. Here's the Venetians' ambassador's report. England has become a nation useless to the rest of the world, and consequently of no consideration. Hang on to your beer there, Venice. Things are about to change. Well, not rapidly, but yeah, over time. One of the things about Cromwell's foreign policy is that this is the first time we are looking at a global strategy. We've sailed to the Mediterranean to belt up pirates operating from Algiers, and Cromwell wouldn't mind getting in control of the sea by occupying Gibraltar or Menorca. He wants a centre in Bremen to give us access to Germany. Part of our deal for France involved England getting control of Dunkirk. That's a handy location to keep an eye on both the Dutchies and the Frenchies. The East India Company can keep setting up bases, and we wouldn't mind knocking over Cartagena, which is Spanish held in Colombia. We're still keen on booting the Dutchies out of North America and the Frenchies out from Canada. Cromwell has a great plan. Will he live long enough to get it all in place will be the question. Answer no. So problems will come up in the future that Cromwell may not have been able to solve. Still, he's got a great plan for anyone with empire on their mind. I suppose that now my brain is caught up with my gob, given that all empires ultimately fail, it's probably a shit plan after all. Concentrate on England, mate. What I think doesn't matter. The door to empire policies is well and truly open. Part of the empire building will see England go from a mainly agricultural economy to an industrial and commercial economy. That's where the money is, and that's also where the modern world is hiding. Oliver can see from the Dutchy example that it'll need the best navy in the world for us to become rulers of the world. Prince Rupert had managed to escape the blockade in Ireland. Parliamentary ships followed him to Portugal and blockaded him again, eventually capturing or destroying all his ships. Portugal will be forced to accept that we now have a naval base there. Yeah, we forced it in. The navy will then go on to defeat the Frenchies at Dunkirk, helping to end the 30 Years' War. The big deal about this win was that the navy had for the first time kept at sea during winter. Frenchies then wanted to go and take Naples, but the English navy will stop that. Hard-manned ships will force ports in North Africa to accept English warships. Spain is now effectively blockaded and English privateers can clean up nicely. English ports extend from Algiers to Dunkirk, with three English fleets operating. We're in the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, and the Baltic. English merchants can go wherever they like in these areas, because we're in charge. All this stuff doesn't pay for itself. Let's have a decimation tax, which is fairly imposed on all royalists. Yeah, if you're a royalist, you're going to pay. Perhaps fairly was the wrong word. Nice way to have the royalists hankering after the good old days when a king ruled. Just to make it even fairer, this tax will be outside the normal exchequer, so it'll be a new chamber of finance under Cromwell's direct control to assess the amount of tax on a case-by-case basis. The spending of the cash will also be at Cromwell's discretion. Meanwhile, the government is raising as much as they can. A merchant will refuse to pay customs duty while challenging the legal basis of the government imposing duties. He's got a reasonable point of view, saying that kings could only be tyrants if the people were compliant and stupid. These things should be challenged. His lawyers will be off to cool their heels in the tower, while the case judge will resign rather than try the case. I'm getting ahead of myself as usual. The Protectorate will now write up an instrument of government. It's a bit like a constitution, and is the what we will end up with in a modern democracy. It says we need a head of state, a Lord Protector, who has an executive council like ministers. This mob does not have the power to tax, make war, or legislate without parliamentary consent. Legislative authority will rest with Parliament, elected each 3 years by all males in England and Wales who were worth £200. Exception will be royalists who are banned from voting for 9 years so they can all cool down. Also banned will be Catholics and Irish rebels who will never ever get the vote. Lord Protector to tick off on the legislation but has no veto power. If he fails to tick off after 6 months, then tough shit, mate, it'll be law. Parliament will approve senior judges who will act independently of Parliament or the Executive. Any form of Protestant religion is accepted with no interference. Go to any Protestant magic show you like. You can even be a ranter if you want. Those are the mob who believe in predestination, so everything's been decided already whether you're going to heaven or hell. On that basis, just get into the booze and fuck like a bunny. Lord Protector gig is for life, for the incumbent, but not hereditary. When he dies, we'll vote for a new one. That last bit will not go down well with die-hard Republicans who will never ever forgive Cromwell for making it a job for life. Apart from that, you may see that this is how modern governments tend to operate. The US Congress, of course, delegated the making of wars to their president about 20 years ago because, let's face it, Congress would never ever say no to a nice new war. And as for the job for life, you may say this allows Lord Protectors, just like a number of our kings, to continue running the show whilst senile dementia creeps in. But our modern political parties seem fond of providing us with candidates who are already demonstrating that senile dementia has crept in. And in the US, Supreme Court judges are appointed for life even while they're going batshit crazy in old age. So long as we pay our taxes and be good little citizens, all should hopefully be well. Back to Cromwell, who is now addressed as His Highness.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we see, no, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
So darling, darling, stand by me.
Stand by me.
Yeah, a little bit of a sing-song there from the wedding of our own Hazza and Megs, His and Her Highness. Are they still that? I don't know. I don't really care. A brief update on Puritan bans for you. Maypoles are cut down. Alehouses are closed. Cockfights are out. Bear baiting's gone. Tough on crime policies for drunks and naughty women renting out their girlish charms. These moves are not popular at all. Jews are back, not because we like the baby Jesus killers. No, it's about fulfilling some dusty old prophecy about a 1,000-year era of saints, then conversions of the Jews, then baby Jesus will turn up again. We can't convert the Jews if we don't have any, so come on in, Jews, wait to be converted. Quakers, of course, will be persecuted. Well, if you're going to say you don't have to follow civil laws, yeah, they'll persecute you. Punishment is branding, whipping and tongue-boring. That was lifted straight out of the Charles I handbook for how to deal with filthy Puritans. Yeah, they used to cop it, now they're giving it. John Cook has become rather in demand as both judge and in advising government on law reform. Cook will get to meet Cromwell's son in Ireland. Yeah, Cromwell's son's running the place. Cook will ask him to do something about the rat-infested flea pits that are Irish prisons, but young Cromwell has pretty much no interest in law reform. He's more interested in hanging out with wealthy English landowners and resisting the attempts of Cook for reform. He wants Cook and his ideas for justice out of Ireland. Sure enough, he'll make life hard for Cook, and Cook will resign. Young Cromwell had pretty much reversed Cook's reforms over there. John Cook's resignation letter is a nice description on the current state of the law and its application. He's in despair over law reform not happening and the almost complete absence of justice. At least in our modern times we have a bit of a go at justice. His career is now not looking good for a 50-year-old. He'd like to spend his remaining years in quiet contemplation, praying and having a good boo-hoo-hoo over the state of the world. That very world that crucified the Son of God. Hang on a tick, Cook, says the government. Our commissioners in Ireland have taken the corruption stuff to a new level and we're missing out on cash, so go and get stuck into them. By the way, our harsh treatment of the Irish isn't going as well as we thought, so as a bonus, have a look at that stuff too. Oh dear, he's got to go against fat, greedy, extremely rich supporters of Parliament and see if he can support Royalist Catholics and Irish. He should have told Parliament to shove it, in my opinion. Give me some decent fucking reforms first. The law he's given to work with is harsh. Irish who want to appeal against land confiscation have to prove they had constant good affection through the last very complicated biff with all sorts of people swapping sides all the time and fuck knows what was going on. People who supported Parliament but made no personal resistance to opposition failed the test. Poor old John Cook has to enforce laws that are pretty much the total opposite of justice. It's all about legalised land theft. He'll cop a case that's just too much for him to bear. The Duke of Ormond's dear old mum, Viscountess Thurles, had protected English families by hiding them in a home and was well known for constantly helping English Protestants. But when the Catholics were in a patch, she failed to pick up a sharp pointy thing and try to get them out. So she's guilty as charged because it wasn't constant support of Parliament. And she should lose everything. Cook will refer the matter to Parliament and say, look, you sort it out. I'm not ruling against her. Back to our glorious Republic, and in 1655, Cromwell accepted his general's plan for direct military rule of England. England will be divided into 11 districts ruled by a major general with his team of professional hard men. Now, this is the sort of stuff that Bill the Bastard did back in fucking 1066. He will further raise a militia. They will be involved in local government in their patch, ensuring that JPs and government did their job. Local governments had been run by the nobility, and now we've got common smelly major generals in their place. This was a bit of bad timing. We're just recovering from the Civil War with some nice law and order in place and the rich families were starting to make money from their privileged social status and common smelly rulers were seen as a threat to social order. These guys are also spreading the bans with the cockfighting stuff and the maypole removal and so on. They've even banned horse racing on security grounds. We don't want sporting events that attract large crowds. Getting drunk, blasphemy and working on Sundays are being suppressed by penalties. That's not too bad. The justices had been doing that already, but only if you're common and smelly will you cop it. Now, a gentleman can't be pissed, blaspheme or work on Sundays. They're also getting stuck into corruption, pissing rich people right off. This has meant we had a standing army, which is great, except it costs an absolute bundle. It'll soon become totally apparent that this was another dick of an idea. It risks a thingy called cantonising. Don't worry about a brand new word, my dear listener. It was only fashionable at this time of our history. Well, to be fair, when I was a boy, South Africa had a form of cantonising called apartheid. It means to make your patch into different areas. For South Africa, well, and the USA at one stage, it was blacks only in these places and whites only in other places. total stupidity as either country could have learned by just picking up a history book. It's been big in Europe. Italy with its city-states, the Holy Roman Empire with its however many states. Right now it's starting the decline of the lowland states. They toyed with it in France at one stage. Perhaps if we put all the Huguenots in one place, we can all live happily ever after. The idea is central rule for areas that have been divided, and it just doesn't work. That's why we find our modern glorious leaders talking out how much we're all just one great big bunch of marvellous Australians or marvellous English, and our country is the best country in the world because of what magnificent humans each and every one of us, we Australians, are. Or we could call it nationalism when it's taken just a tiny bit too far. The military rule is a threat to country society and national unity. Those dear old rulers of local government were left to their own devices with no national government or regional council strong enough to overcome their territorial rule. Bit shitty for the common smellies, but it worked. This is why we now have federal laws with unified policies on foreign affairs, trade and national security and so on, then state laws suitable to the main activities of each state, then local laws to suit the local population. Those dear darling major generals, though, have power and they want to keep it. They don't want to be tossed out. A petition to give the system up had been presented and the major generals will strike back saying, "Hey, Cromwell, how does King Oliver the First sound?" Not a new idea for them. People have suggested it before because at least with the monarchy, we have a pretty good idea of how things run. That will have the brainiacs in Parliament and government running around with ideas about a different type of monarchy. Perhaps not hereditary, but a pass to whoever is military leader at the time type of stuff. Cromwell isn't getting any younger, so the succession is a problem, like it was under the Gloriana. Like the Gloriana, Cromwell is in no rush to sort it out. You may be thinking, just hold an election, but the problem with an election is that our team may not win. At least the army can chip in to resolve the question whether Cromwell should become King Oliver the First. They'll say, "Look, if you take a crown, mate, we'll shoot you in the head." Yeah, well, that sorted that one out. Meantime, in the confusion that's occurred by going from a monarchy to a republic with wishy-washy religious policies, we're getting more and more different religions. An English guy who'd gone to the lowlands had come up with the Baptist concept. Oh, no, not the Baptists. Too late. It's in England now. It's spread. We've caught it. Now, Baptist, my dear listener, is not the same as Anabaptist. Both say baptism can only happen to a consenting adult, but the Baptists are into the justification by the faith alone or predetermination, while the Anabaptists go for the justification by good deeds or free will. No wonder they hate each other. Not convinced? Anabaptists, this is the real killer. Anabaptists can be a bit on the communist side, and of course there is more than one type of Anabaptists. Amish, Hutterites and so on, and more than one type of Baptists, like the Southern Baptists, who want to be involved in government and the military and whatever, and they wouldn't mind ruling the world. If we'd all just get out of the way, thank you very much. The stuff is a headache for Parliament, and we've seen they already decided to persecute the odd Quaker. The religious policy will end up being action, take no action. Let the divisions happen so we can try to play off one side against the other. But by 1658, Oliver is not a well dictator. His favourite daughter Elizabeth will die. Cancer got her. Like Betty, he's still not saying much about the succession. In comes malaria for Cromwell, who will refuse the only known treatment, quinine. I wonder what scientific basis he used to reject the medicine. No, I don't. I know why. It was discovered by filthy Jesuits. And you can't take papist medicine. It might keep you alive. Now comes a urinary tract infection, nice and painful. That may have led to septicemia, but I think we should just cut to the chase. 3rd of September 1658, Oliver Cromwell is dead. Oh, boo hoo hoo. We'll be right back. Well, there you go. Somehow we've managed to get into historical fiction. I tried a couple of books this week. First one was Canal Dreams by Ian Banks. Can't really call it historical fiction because it's a made-up story about some people stuck in the Panama Canal while there's a bit of a revolution going on. I quite like Ian Banks, and I didn't mind this book, although, really, he puts his main character through some pretty rough shit just after he's built up all that empathy. You really like her, and then she's got to go through all this shit. And, of course, she's going to meet a CIA guy who is larger than life and represents all that's wrong with the CIA. Still, good read, Canal Dreams, Ian Banks, if you don't mind a bit of nastiness. The other one, Stallion Gate by Martin Cruz Smith. Now, this is an American author who is noted for his Gorky Park series, fictional stuff set in Russia. Very good, very popular stuff. But this one, Stallion Gate, is in New Mexico when we're trying to see if we can make an atomic bomb work with the physicists, Oppenheimer and so on. But it's really the story of a kind of ordinary guy, Joe Penner, a sergeant who's working there, and he's a Native American guy. And once again, I really quite enjoyed this. It was a totally different kind of look at that whole atomic bomb. If you're expecting tons of stuff about physicists, well, you know, there's some stuff in there, but it's really an adventure story. Rather good. Stallion Gate by Martin Cruz Smith. But for us, it's just a matter of what we're going to go out with. And I'd like to introduce you to Jenia, who is a young woman, composer, concert pianist, and founder of something called Piano Yoga, which sounds a bit interesting, I guess. But anyway, let's go out with a bit of Jenia and Vals a la Francaise. Hope to see you next week. Bye.